Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. The Covenants of the Gods, Chapter 1. Holy Matrimony versus Marriage.
Holy Matrimony versus Marriage is one of the first pamphlets I ever wrote. It was written in a fit of passion after my father had left me with his law books when he retired from the law, and I had been reading those law books every day, mostly beginning with Black's Law Dictionary, then Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law and other books. I knew that Samuel Johnson had once said that words are but the signs of ideas, but I had no idea that those signs could mean so many different things. The location of a sign will tell you something different in one place than it does in another. Words can mean something different depending on where they're used, who is using them, and when they are being used. If you're using words in a legal setting, you should be using a legal dictionary to determine what they're talking about. The assumption that people are telling you what you think they're telling you because you have a definition in your mind as to the meaning of those words is a very dangerous assumption. Words don't always mean the same. When we're looking at the Bible, we see written in English, whether using the King James or other translations and versions of the Bible, they don't necessarily translate them perfectly. No translation is perfect. It is always advisable to go back to the original Greek text and look at what word was used there to find out what English definition you should apply to a given word. The word world, five different Greek words are translated into the single English word world. Which one was used in the context of where you're looking at it? There are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 definitions of the word world in the English dictionary. Which one is best suited to fit upon that word? Are we talking world planet? Are we talking Disney World? Are we talking the world in general as an inhabited place? Or the world that we know in a particular time or sequence? What are we talking? Wayne's World what? We need to know what that original Greek word is in order to understand in depth what the authors are really telling us. In Acts 7, verse 19, we see the same dealt subtly with our kindred and evil entreated our fathers so that they cast out their young children to the end that they might not live. Well, the word there for young children is actually brephos in the Greek, which really normally would mean fetus. And this idea of casting out our fetuses really had to do with abortion. Even the word that is translated might not live is actually better translated might not bring forth alive. Abortion was around in those days. It was around in the time of the Hippocratic Oath. It says in there, thou shalt give no pessary, which simply means an abortive substance. Why were these abortions taking place? Because they evil entreated our fathers, because they had laid great burdens on them. And they were no longer under Joseph in this bondage in Egypt, but that bondage had become more and more severe, and the economic burdens and drudgery of that bondage. The word same dealt subtly, that dealt subtly actually comes from a Greek word that is comprised of several different Greek words containing the Greek sophizo, which actually means to circumvent by artifice or fraud, conquer by subtle devices, to outwit, to devise cleverly or cunningly, to play the sophist. Sophist, it's characterized by Plato as a superficial manipulator of rhetoric and dialect. By changing the meaning of words in our minds, we change the meaning of the original author. And it's so important to realize that these words are symbols of ideas, and it's not enough to have an idea of what the Bible says today. It's important to know what the author meant. In order to do that, we must study to show ourselves approved and rightly divide the word of truth. And there are many men out there studying and seeking to know that truth, but there's lots of different opinions, lots of different ideas coming out of these seminaries. They've become somewhat uniform in the last 100 years or so, but the fact is that there is a great difference between what men, scholars, have as an opinion as to what the Bible actually says. Because it's a big book, and language is so much babble. Because every word can have so many different meanings. And which one are we going to put here? And if you do that with 5 different words in a sentence, and 100 different words in a paragraph, and 1,000 different words in a book, it's difficult to tell what is actually being said unless we start to look at the whole theme of the Bible and see what keeps popping up. And of course, we need to pray and ask the Holy Spirit. Daniel Webster, who wrote one of the early dictionaries in America and has come down to us as the Webster's Dictionary, says, "All the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war proceed from their despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. If we abide by the principles taught in the Bible, our country will go on prospering. But if we neglect its instruction and authority, no man can tell how soon a catastrophe may overcome us and bury all our glory in profound obscurity. The ways of civilizations have always been to rise up to a peak of affluence and then decay down into a time of decay and destruction and debilitation. Is that what's happening in America? We see America setting aside the concepts of the Bible. We see them taking concepts like the Ten Commandments out of public buildings and out of schools, etc. And what do we see? We see the end result. This is not a new event. This has happened time and time again. Why is it happening? Do we really understand what the Bible says even when we pick it up? Are we victims of sophistry already? Have people changed the meaning of words so that we don't really understand what the original authors were telling us? Let's go back to the beginning of the Bible and find out, what is the Bible all about? It's about man. It's about man's relationship with God and man's relationship with institutions of man that often interfere with man's relationship with God. We'll look at Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over it. And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet for him. And that helpmeet is woman. But when you say helpmeet, it sounds a little subordinate there, but really they were both created in the image of God. They were both created for a particular purpose, and that purpose is God's. And he also created them so they needed one another. Even the word helpmeet there in the original Hebrew, it's 3 Hebrew letters, and that those same Hebrew letters are also translated in another word as treasure. This is a necessary part of man. He needs that woman not only to procreate and to be fruitful, but as a spiritual creature to test the mettle of that man. Without her, he would probably... Well, the joke is, of course, is that God looked into Adam's refrigerator and realized that he needed a helpmeet. But man is improved by a proper and godly relationship with woman. That's why God created that woman for that purpose, and vice versa. They need one another in order to become all they can be in the eyes of God. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the sea and the let the fowls multiply in the earth. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. This is a structure that God had planned from the beginning, man and woman. It is part of the design in this creation we call mankind. In Matthew 19, verse 3 through 6, we see the Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? There's that concept. from the beginning, male and female, for a purpose. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. This is what God intended from the beginning. Even Jesus tells us this. We see it in the Old Testament. We see it in the New Testament. This is not something new. This is not something odd or strange. It is part of God's plan. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? This is another controversial question. They're not giving up so easy. He say unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. Jesus made it clear, that is not God's plan. It happens, but it's not God's plan. And if it happens, it's probably because of the hardness of somebody's heart. They're unforgiving nature. And we will suffer for these events. And many people have suffered for these events. But if we understand how God wants that to be a permanent relationship, before we enter into that relationship, we will take it very seriously. We will contemplate that commitment. But what is that commitment? This organization we call family, husband, wife, and the fruitful children that are multiplied from them. This is ordained by God that this should be. It's a binding of two as one flesh. No more twain in the eyes of God. In the eyes of God, they're one. They're not separable. Fundamental. It's foundational. It's from the beginning of even creation. It's the foundation of all society and all government. Is actually found in family. And we'll see some of that. When the foundation fails, all fails. This is the key to the success of any society. When the family is breaking down, as we saw in Rome, as we see in other cultures, when the family breaks down, the whole society begins to break down and becomes corrupt. If you want to dominate and oppress a people, first you oppress the women. That's a concept that has come down to us through the age. If people doubt that, they better study their history a little bit more. You have to break down the marriage, that matrimonial bonds, to separate the children, separate husband and wife so that bond is not permanent. And then you will be able to control the people. If you can't, the treasure of that relationship will be destroyed. Holy matrimony is the basic union and structure laid down by God for the dominion of man and woman and their families upon this earth. And how does it come about? It comes about through a covenant, a natural covenant between man and woman and God. The Bible talks to us about covenant from the beginning to the end. Hundreds and hundreds of times they talk about it. They call it leagues. They call it covenants. It's contracts. It's agreements with parties involved. What you give as your yes is yes and your no is no. And oaths are even worse. And Jesus tells us that. But Exodus tells us, thou shalt make no covenants with them, nor with their gods. Over and over again, that is repeated throughout the text. Well, if we talk about contracts and covenants, we're talking about things that to do with the law. And of course, law is a broad range of subjects. There's all kinds of law. But basically, there's the fundamental laws that God has set down from the beginning, which we see defined in things like the Ten Commandments. And they're pretty basic. They're almost common sense. It doesn't require a degree in knowledge or law in order to know that to kill somebody is not a good thing. It should be obvious to murder, to steal what is not yours. Although some people have a problem with seeing that there's something wrong with that. And it seems a shame that we have to actually write it down. But the fact is that it has been written down. The Ten Commandments and those same concepts over and over again, the fundamentals of it, have been written down throughout the ages. And of course, the Ten Commandments was not a religious document. It was a document that was the fundamental law for an entire nation of people. The same as the 12 tablets of Rome were the fundamental law that covered the legal system that was amongst the people as they created it over the first 500 years of the Roman government. It wasn't an empire really until the first emperor was Augustus, which was 500 years after its beginning or even more. So let's look at the law and see some basic concepts in what the law is all about. Common law is the law of the land in America. And there is also statutory law. That's another kind of law that is also operates side by side with the common law, but it is also subject to law. You can't just make any kind of statute. There are limitations both by constitution and by basic laws of morality and the maxims of law that have come down to us throughout the ages. There are other systems of law like equity as well. But here in Blacks, we'll look at one little statement that kind of covers a broad range of the concepts of law that we'll be dealing with here to deal with marriage and matrimony. An analysis of the science of law presents a view, first, of the rights of persons, distinguishing them from natural persons and artificial persons. Well, even the word persons at all should always raise red flags in your mind. But also, body politics or corporations. These rights are deemed either absolute, as relating to the enjoyment of personal security, liberty, and private property, or, on the other hand, relative. So, absolute rights have to do with inalienable rights granted to us by God. And there's another group of rights that are relative rights that have to do with our status, with agreements that we have made, with events that we have done that have created a relative relationship and therefore a relative concept of rights. And that it arises out of this relationship in which several persons stand. So in order to have this relationship, it always requires another individual or another person in order to create a relationship. It's not a soulful, singular thing. Yet those inalienable rights are yours if you're the last man on earth. These relationships are either first public or political. So they divide that. There's public on one side or political on the other. The relationship of magistrate and people, or second, as private, as the relationship of master and servant, husband and wife, parent and child, guardian and ward, to which might be added relationships arising out of private contract, such as partnerships, principal and agent, and the like. Now, this is from Bouvier's. This is a very old dictionary, legal dictionary. It was used at the time of the Constitution. It's still used now because you have to use a dictionary used at the time. Can't use a modern Webster's dictionary to determine what the Constitution is all about. It is the intent of the original document that is important. This is why, in order to understand the Bible, we must look back in history. You can't just use a Webster's dictionary and a King James Bible and figure out what it says, because since the King James Bible was written, the language has changed. Things can get lost in translation. And so therefore you need to study to find out exactly what it is that the author meant, not necessarily what the translator meant. But the interesting point here in this thing that I read about the law and this analysis of the science of law is that they say that first there is public or political, the relationship of magistrate and people, or second, are private, as a relationship of master and servant, husband and wife, parent and child. They categorize husband and wife as a private relationship. Even contract is a private relationship. And of course, we know in the Constitution, the right to contract shall not be infringed. We often see that now you have to become a licensed contractor. Well, to demand a license to do something that you have an inalienable right to do would be unlawful, and the statutes have no authority to require a license to contract unless that contractual relationship falls under some sort of status condition that the statutes do have authority on. And you may be required to get a license to contract in certain circumstances. We talk about that in a lot of other studies. Basically, I just wanted to show you that husband and wife and parent and child, even guardian and ward, are considered at the time of Bouvier's to be private relationships, not relationships over on the side of magistrate and people, public and political. it's over on the side of private. Now, that's not necessarily what you have today with marriages, and we'll take a look at why that is. But at one time, that was the case with marriages. They were a private relationship, and there was no way in which the courts could interfere with that contractual relationship of marriage. That came in much later as things evolved, although it's not a new idea. It's a very old idea, and we'll look at that also. Law, as distinguished from equity, denotes the doctrine and procedures of the common law of England and America, from which equity is a departure. We deal a great deal in equity in America today. It's an administrative system of law, and it is a departure from what we call the law, although many of the things that we see in equitable relationships or equitable situations. For instance, when I first read Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law, it talked about rights of the husband, rights of the wife, rights to custody of the children. And this was all under this one chapter called Husband and Wife. And then there was another chapter called Marriage. And it said rights of the husband, rights of the wife, rights to the custody of children. But it had a different remedy. One was the remedy was at law. And the other one, the remedy was in equity. And when equity began to raise its maybe we could say ugly head, but that would be a judgment statement. But whatever it was, when it began to become a greater influence in the law, there were so many contracts that were at law before that, they needed to write at the bottom of a contract that the remedies for this contract were in equity. Because otherwise, everybody would assume that the remedies for this contract were at law, and a different set of procedures would follow. But later on, as time went on, equity began to have greater and greater influence. And by merely the way in which the contract was written, we would know that the remedies are at equity. In the Judiciary Act of 1789, which we can't get into all in this study session, but and it has to do with the law, and we do that in the law versus legal a little bit more in depth. But basically, the common law is the law of the land, but where there is no remedy at common law, the remedy is found in equity. Well, if you create a contract where there would be no remedy at common law, then you automatically, that contract or agreement or application is going to fall under equity. It's a whole different system of law. It's a departure from law. So a lot of times when we say you have to obey the law, you're actually saying we have to obey the equitable agreement or contract that we have created. It may be law now, but it's only law by contract. The union of man and woman is of the law of nature. That's a maximum law that stems way back into the Roman times and still found in modern law books. But that's not the only union that we will see. Just because you say you're married, that's not necessarily the union of man and woman. The laws of nature are most perfect and immutable, but the conditions of human law is an unending succession, and there is nothing in it which can continue perpetually. Human laws are born, live, and die. Again, another maxim come down to us throughout the ages. Husband and wife are considered one person in law. Again, another maxim. According to the law and the common law, all things which are the wife's belong to the husband. And they twain are one flesh, so then they are no more twain but one flesh. This union of husband and wife is, in the old Roman law, a manus, so the wife comes and is joined with the husband. Everything that was hers is now both of theirs. They're one individual. That concept is biblical. Romans used it. It's in the law over and over again. It is not always what we see in the relationships today, because the relationships today have been a departure from the law. We call it law still, but it's really equity. Bigelow says equity winks at the law, because it looks a lot like that, but it isn't the law. It may be law because they have bound you in a contract, but you have agreed to that. You have made that law. You have gone under that authority. Submitting yourselves one to another in fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. A lot of people want to use this first part of the quotation to make their wives submissive and oppressed in the family. We're partners in this. We're equal partners in this. Yes, there is someone who has one position of authority and another one who has another position, which is also of authority, because you can't separate them. They may separate themselves, but really you want to get them together. Well, how did Christ love the church? By sacrifice, by service. And I find that women don't mind obeying husbands who truly cherish their wives, who make their decisions in the best interest of their wives, and have truly loved them as Christ loved the church. The problem comes when they don't. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies? He that loveth his wife loveth himself, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. Well, that's true, but yes, there is wickedness where people do hate themselves, and they hate everything around them, and they are not at peace. But we're talking about Christian people who really love God, and therefore do love themselves, because they know they are a creation of God, and they must love their wives, and their wives must love their husbands. Let the husbands render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. This is a reciprocating relationship. These are one thing. I mean, you cannot kill the right side of the body without killing the left. And so this is an important concept, and it comes back to us again in Mark 10. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. These are all important concepts to understand in marriage. Now, we're going to take this a little bit farther, and we're going to look a little bit at the history of law concerning marriage and matrimony. And why the history? Well, we've been doing that. We look back at Genesis. We look back at the time of Christ and the apostles and men like Paul. So now, what do we know about this whole concept in relationship? We've talked a little bit about this equity thing and common law thing. Is this something new that came out of England, or is this as old as the hills themselves? Now, a number of these maxims of law that stem way back into ancient times are just repeating these precepts that we see in the Bible in Genesis and at the time of Christ. And yes, many times we see things mentioned in the Bible, and we know, like divorce and these things that seem like they are separations from the principles of God. And of course, Jesus tells them it wasn't that way from the beginning. And of course, we're not just trying to get back to the Old Testament. We're trying to get back to the way God wants us to be. But these maxims include the ideas of the union of man and woman is of the law of nature. And in our study on law, we see that the law of nature is really defined as divine will. The laws of nature are unchangeable, another maxim of law. But one is very interesting. Matrimony ought to be free. Now, how does that relate to the Bible? Well, it's very clear that for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. That means that he is outside of the authority and control of his father. He still must honor his father, but it's at his discretion and choice. And if he were to die, his wife and children would fall back on the burden of his father caring for him. And so that's why there was this honorarium that was passed up to the father, because the father would care for those children if something happened to him. It was part of the social structure. Nowadays, the state stands in the position of father, and often we contribute to it, and it's supposed to take care of us. But originally, that was the state, is the patriarchal system of fathers and grandfathers were the state and the government. All government is based on the family, and it's simply the state taking over the role of the father that has allowed it to become this gigantic family. There was other systems by which to do this that were not top-down authority. They were grassroots systems that were bound together by faith, hope, and love. And of course, that's what Moses tried to create. That's what Jesus Christ preached. But basically, we want to understand that matrimony ought to be free. There should be no strings. The in-laws can't come over and start dictating to this husband and wife as to what they could do and they could not do. There was a certain responsibility that they needed to work out between each other, but there was no authority. Matrimony ought to be free. Now, matrimony is defined as marriage in the sense of the relationship or status, not the ceremony itself. We're using that word matrimony as distinguished from marriage for a good reason, but marriage is not necessarily something distinct. It has usually more to do with the way in which this matrimony came about. Status, the legal position of the individual in or with regard to the rest of community. The rights, duties, and capacities and incapacities which determine a person to give to a given class constitute his status. So we just had two different definitions of status, one as an individual in regards to the rest of community. So he's separate from the community, an individual. But the person, when we use that term, the rights, duties, and capacities and incapacities which determine a person to a given class constitute his status. So these are two basic concepts of status. Statuses are different depending on whether you're a person or an individual, what contracts and capacities that you have gone under, you know, the situation of your life. So that's an important concept to remember, and we'll return to that. But right now, let's look at Rome. Rome had this concept of matrimony. They called it matrimonium, which is, of course, where we get the word matrimony. They had several different forms of matrimonium, ferarum, coemptio, and usus. Those are Latin terms. Ferarum actually has to do with the word grain. And so if you were married con ferratio, that meant you were married with grain. And of course, today we actually see at weddings people are throwing rice. Okay, that's where that came from. That's with grain is the concept. But the legal or lawful position of that relationship was very interesting in Rome. That was the way in which was most prized to be married. And the families wanted to be married according to that conferratio. This was called matrimonium juris gentium. And the concept there included the idea, gentium really has to do with family. It became known as nation in the law of nation, jus gentium. But matrimonium juris gentium had to do with the law of the family, juris meaning law. And it was the family in which this whole relationship took place. The woman moved her manus, all her rights and possessions that was let go by her father with her, moved over into this new family. And basically, if it was free, which of course the Romans were prized themselves on their free matrimony, all those things went into the husband and wife's family. And people actually brought bags of grain, not just throw a little rice, and they enriched the family so that they would begin their life in a proper independent fashion. Later on, there became a different kind of matrimonium due to the statutory requirements that began to pop up, and this was called legitimum matrimonium. It was a much different type of relationship than the one that was under the family. This other relationship we see, usus, was simply living together for a year. And there was no manus of the wife united with the other. And it actually came into popularity with servants who came into Rome to work. Coemptio was kind of a fictional sale or contract where the manus of the bride was entailed over to the husband. And often there were lots of agreements and stipulations. But the pure form of matrimonium was this conferratio, which was a free matrimony. When you went over, you were now completely free in this other unit. Both the husband and wife were free. So that was a concept. Actually, that's a biblical concept. Why does Rome have it? Rome knew all about Israel. They were great historians. They knew how that government was established. When they threw out the Tarquinian kings, they created a government very similar to those ancient patriarchal system created by Moses. Now, a lot of the rituals and robes were changed, but many of the principles and precepts were there. There were some Roman variations, and those variations grew, especially as they came in contact with the Greeks. But it was a very similar system, and it prevailed for almost 400 or 500 years in Rome. It became corrupt also, just as it had become corrupt in Israel. All government without consent of the governed is the very definition of slavery. What is mine cannot be taken away without consent. A contract is law between the parties having received their consent. Now these are maxims of law. Actually, that first was Jonathan Swift who said that. But basically, governments obtain a great deal of their power and position and authority by our consent. We have to agree to it. I mean, somebody can't just come in and say, we're the government, now everybody has to do this, that, and the other thing, and start making all kinds of statutes. They gain power because we consent to give them that power. God gave us that power. They have no rights. Governments have no inalienable rights. They obtain rights when the people waive their rights. That's how government works. If you waive a lot of rights, then the government has a lot of power. If you waive very few rights, the government has very little power. They don't have power because they write up a constitution and agree they like it. We have to agree we like it too. And that's the way it works. That's the way it always works. Now, you can have pirate-type governments who come in with force of arms and conquer the people and, you know, put a gun to their head and say, you have to do this, and, well, maybe you have to do that, or he'll shoot you. But that's just, you're just seized by pirates. They don't have any authority to say that. And as soon as you get a drop on them, you can take that gun away from them and say, now you do this, because you're a thief. You're stealing my rights. You're usurping authorities I have not yet consented to. And, of course, that's what David did with Goliath. Goliath said he was the authority, and David said, oh, no, you're not. God is the authority, and hit him in the head with a rock, because he kept saying that he was the authority and trying to rule over Israel, and that was not permitted. So governments gain power because we give it to them. So this concept of contracts, of course, immediately comes into this relationship of matrimony. And it does so by way of this marriage, which is this ceremony or act. And that can vary greatly and end up with much different results. So let's look at Bouvier's. That's that older dictionary at the time of the Constitution, what they say about marriage. And they say it's a contract made in due form of law, not talking equity here, by which a free man and a free woman reciprocally engage to live with each other during their joint lives in the union which ought to exist between husband and wife. By the terms free man and free woman in this definition are meant not only that they are free and not slaves, but also that they are clear of all bars to a lawful marriage. Now that's what they're telling us. Now what would be one of the bars to a lawful marriage? Well, Daddy didn't say that she could get married. She's still under the authority of her father. She can't go get married until he gives his permission. So that's one of the bars. The definition goes on to say, to make a valid marriage, the parties must be willing to contract, able to contract, and have actually contracted. And of course, there are terms of contract which we go into elsewhere. But basically, there has to be an agreement, a meeting of minds, there has to be an exchange, and they have to come there, you know, part of that agreement, honestly, and of course, they have to have capacity. All these things are mentioned there. Willing to contract, in other words, you understand the agreement, able to contract, that there are no bars, and that you have actually done this and made the exchange. You know, if you don't say I do, it didn't happen. Even the word wedding that we have, that actually comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, wed, which means a covenant, an agreement. And so marriage has always had this concept of agreement. You have to agree. There's a, even with Isaac, there was an exchange and an agreement before they ever even met. It was someone else was carrying this out, but eventually they weren't really married until they moved in together, and then the contract was completed. So in Black Third, we see a contract is talked about a little bit differently. A contract according to the form prescribed by law, still law, by which a man and a woman capable of entering into such a contract mutually engage with each other to live their whole lives together in the state of union which ought to exist between husband and wife. So that's almost identical, a little bit different. It's Black's Third. That's an older dictionary. I think they're up to Black's Eighth or Ninth now. And the definition has been altered somewhat in those books, or at least it's beginning to slide more in a different direction. But one of the most common maxims of law that you'll see, like at the United Nations or in United Nations documents, is pacta sunt servanda. Pacta sunt servanda. Agreements must be kept. Well, of course, non pacta, non servanda, if there is no agreement, it doesn't have to be kept. So you have to make this contract, and basically what we're talking about here is a contract between two people. Now, is it holy matrimony where it's a contract between two people before God, or is it just living together like usus, where they just make a contract between themselves? Is the contract, who is the authority over the contract? Where is the remedies? Is it at law or is it in equity? Well, of course, that's a big question. That makes a big difference into what that thing we call status is. Remember status? There was the status of the individual in regards to the rest of the community, but also status are rights, duties, capacities, and incapacities, which determine a person to a given class, which constitute a status. So your status may mean that you're not in a matrimony that is free, depending on how you conducted that ceremony of marriage. That which bars those that have contracted will bar their successors also. So this is going to even have an effect on their children. And so we're going to look at a couple of definitions that come along a little bit later and are actually talking about something that's quite different than what we talked about up here, as this perpetual joint lives as husband and wife that ought to be free, that is done by two free people. We're going to talk about another relationship, looks very much the same, uses many of the same words, but is quite different in its status. So we've seen marriage as simply a contract between a free man and a free woman, husband and wife. They consent, they contract, they're able to make the contract, and they actually make the exchange or the agreement or consummate the act. Now, there are many ways in ancient history to do this. The old marriage under the canopy, formal gatherings and get-togethers where they exchange vows in the public and everybody knows what's happening and what's going on. And then they go home and they consummate the marriage. They set up housekeeping, all open and above board and all completely married. No one else needed. Now, there is this word marriage used by another group of people. Same word, marriage, spelled exactly the same way, but they're talking about a different condition, a different definition. And we'll find that definition in the same dictionary, but it is a much different type of relationship. And we want to know, is this second relationship in accordance with God and what God wants for man and woman in this very sacred relationship that we call husband and wife? Marriage, as distinguished from the agreement to marry and from the act of becoming married, is a civil status of one man and one woman united in law for the discharge to each other and to the community of duties legally incumbent on those whose association is founded on the distinction of sex. Now, when I first read that many, many, many years ago, I thought that sounded pretty good, but then I began to find out what words mean. They're distinguishing this marriage from the agreement to marry and from actually becoming married. The other definition included those things. But specifically, they're telling us that this marriage is a civil status. That's very important. It's a civil status. It's not a free status. There are strings attached. We call those strings duties legally incumbent. So it's not a free marriage or free matrimony. There are obligations, and it is all done under an authority and provides with it, at the end of the event, a different status than that private contract of marriage. So marriage is a personal relationship arising out of a civil contract to which the consent of the parties capable of making it is necessary. Consent alone will not constitute the marriage. It must be solemnized. It must be followed by a solemnization of that consent or by a mutual assumption of marital rights, duties, or obligations. Now, that's from the California Civil Codes. And they're saying, of course, that it is a civil contract. It's not just a private contract. It's a civil contract. So as soon as you read that, you know you're already been removed from that private side of law. And now you're in the public side of law and you're under the authority of the magistrate, the civil magistrate. He is now the authority of this contract. He has power over it. He is the god of this contract. He will exercise authority over this. You have literally written down there at the bottom by applying and obtaining this license that that's okay with you. You have consented to that. And you have solemnized that with this application and marriage ceremony. You go and get a licensed minister who has permission from the state to perform these civil contracts. That's not holy matrimony. That's not an ecclesiastical matrimony, and we'll see that in a minute. Marriage is a union of one man and one woman, so long as they both shall live, to the exclusion of all others, by an obligation which during that time the parties cannot of their own volition and act dissolve, but which can only be dissolved by the authority of the state. They are not joined together by God. They are joined together by the state. And the state has taken on the position of God. And the more you hear from us, the more you will realize exactly what that means. But we'll look at Ohio's references to marriage. So that was California. The last one was Washington. And now we're over in Ohio. And we could go through all the states. But these are just a few that I put together for today. Ohio marriage law documents. This is actually copyrighted out of the Ohio State Bar Association. Marriage is a legal as well as a spiritual and personal relationship. When you repeat your marriage vows, you enter into a legal contract. Remember, the word legal comes from the Latin lex legere, which means to bind. It's not the same as law. Things become law because you bind yourself by contract, and that's how you make the law. You're not under this contract until you consent to it. You're not under those duties and obligations until you go under those by consenting and contracting under them. You don't have to do that in order to become married. You choose to do that maybe from ignorance, maybe because you want some special benefit that you think you'll get from that. There are three parties to that legal contract: you, your spouse, and the state of Ohio. Now, I can't get much clearer than that. They're telling you this is a three-party contract between you, your wife, or your spouse, and the state of Ohio. The state is a party to the contract because under its laws, you have certain obligations and responsibilities to each other, to any children you may have, and to Ohio. What you do when you make that contract, that's how you get those duties. If you don't make the contract, there are no duties. Pacta servanda sunt. Non pacta, non servanda sunt. No agreement, no obligations. Agreements must be kept. If there is no agreement, then you have no obligation. You don't owe the state of Ohio anything, as long as you don't enter into a lot of other contracts with the state of Ohio. Remember, the law of nature is most perfect and immutable, which is the divine will. But the conditions of human law is unending succession, and there is nothing in it which can continue perpetually. Human laws are born, live, and die. And how are they born? They're born by your consent. You have to consent. That's why they want you to make these contracts. You're giving them power. 1906, the Supreme Court of Nebraska states, it, referring to marriage, differs from all other contracts in its far-reaching consequences to the body politic itself, and for that reason, in dealing with it or the status resulting therefrom, the state never stands indifferent, but is always a party whose interests must be taken into account. How does this all come about? Marriage license. A license is permission granted by public authority to persons who intend to intermarry. By statute, it is made an essential prerequisite to the lawful solemnization of marriage. But that has to do with that marriage that is a civil contract. And we know that there are other kinds of marriages that are not civil contracts. So when we want to get marriage, should we go and get a marriage license to the state? We know that a license, from this point of view, or permission granted by public authority to a person who is intending to intermarry, That's what that is. But that is also entering into a contract. Now let's look at Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law. That's a very fundamental book, and it's one of the first ones I began to read. You know, all lawyers should have read this, but you'll find, as I found with some where the lawyer underlined when he had it in school, He never underlined anything under constitutional law, and he very seldom underlined anything under the common law, because that's not what lawyers today are dealing with, even though from the very beginning in America, common law was the law of the land. That was the one that had precedent over all other systems of law. Equity could only find remedies where there it was no remedy at common law, especially if you made a contract or an application where the remedy was already decided to be in equity. You're no longer at the law. Remember, equity is a departure from the law. So I don't want you to break the law. I want you to go back to the law and stop going under this equity, which is a departure from the law, and waiving your God-given rights. But Clark's summary states, marriage is often referred to as a civil contract, but the emphasis in such a reference is not upon the word contract, but upon the word civil, as distinguished from ecclesiastical. Since there is religious freedom in this country, a religious ceremony and rules of ecclesiastical organizations with regard to marriage have no legal significance. Legal meaning binding significance as far as the civil aspect of the contract. Now, when you go to church and get married, that's not an ecclesiastical marriage. That's a civil contract. That's a civil agreement because your minister has often gone down to the local county seat and got permission to perform this marriage. That's not their business. They shouldn't be doing that. They should be separate from the state. They shouldn't be performing solemnizations for the state as a clerk of the state. They're supposed to be the clerk of God, clerk of the kingdom of heaven. They're supposed to be serving Christ. They're supposed to be entering people under the perfect law of liberty into holy matrimony, which is free because we know it ought to be free. And they should be binding those people not under the state, where the state now has exercising authority over their relationship, but they should be binding them as a witness, not with any particular authority, but as a witness under the authority of God, not under the authority of the church or the state. And the state agrees with this. This is Clark's summary. This is a fundamental law book. They're telling you this. This is not a secret. Nobody's revealing it to you, and your minister should be. And if you're a minister, you should learn this and start telling people, because this is a part of the gospel, and we'll show that after a bit here. Though mutual assent is necessary to enter into a marriage, the marriage itself is a status or relationship rather than a contract. The rights and obligations of the parties thereto being fixed by law instead of by the parties themselves. In other words, you agree to give the state the power to decide what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil in your relationship. This is not holy matrimony. This is a legal binding agreement between you, your spouse, and the state. You're going under an authority. Hence, marriages are not within the provision of the United States Constitution forbidding the states to impair the obligation to contract. So this is really important to understand that I'm not saying that you should break the law. I'm saying that you should abide by the law. And the law says that you can get married as a private contract. You may need a license, but you don't want to get that license from the state. Remember, license is permission. You want to get that license from your parents if you're still within your household. Because there, even Samson went and got permission from his father to get married. Daughters should get permission from their fathers and their mothers because they're a part of the family. They're a part of that union. As the husband and wife are one flesh, the children are within that household and under the coverture of that household. And so therefore, when they want to get married, they need to get that permission. And when they get that permission, that's their license. If they're going to the state, then they have put the state in the position or in the role of father. And of course, we know Jesus said, call no man on earth father, but my father in heaven. And he did so when it was very clear that the Roman emperors were called our father, Patronus, and all the senators were called patri, father. And we find in that Greek text where it says, call no man on earth patri. Same word. And so all the people knew exactly what he meant. And as we talk more frequently, we'll see how this system works and plays out in relationship to the Bible. Until we meet again, peace on your house, and may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.